I'm Dave Engelstead and a pastor at a Lutheran church in Minneapolis. I'm starting today a three-part series on shame, codependency, and addiction. One of the things I learned last week was that it works well to complete each topic in one session so that if you aren't able to make another one, then you won't be missing anything. So today we'll be spending our whole time talking about shame. And I come by that in a number of different ways, come by my experience with these topics in a number of different ways. One is my own family background and personal experience. I'm in a couple different 12-step recovery groups, so I hear that language in those settings. At seminary, the topics of family systems and family dysfunction is something that I spent some time with, and also just in my conversation with friends and other people. I've come by this language as a way of naming experience, and for me it's been a very helpful one. It's opened up some doors, and so I'm sharing these things largely to do the same, or hopefully to offer the same possibility for you. It's a language that's a way of naming our experience that for some I think can be extremely helpful. And so what I'm going to invite you to do is listen to it and see how it helps to name your experience. We'll spend some time talking about your experience and you can see what to make of it at the end. There's a lot of different ways to talk about shame, but I want to start with a personal example. And it sometimes is a poor way to begin to talk about myself, but it might be easier than asking you to talk about yourselves right away. This will sound familiar, and it may be that for you, your aha experience today will simply be to say, oh, that's what shame is? I know what that is all about. But the other day, I was in Minneapolis with my daughter, Kara, shopping at a store called Best Buy. It's a large discount store that markets stereo goods and camera products and other things. I was looking for a camera lens, and my daughter Kara is 3.5 and does pretty well at being careful about things that are on the counter. We've had lots of conversations about how you handle things. I also have a 35mm camera that she has played with before. Play in quotation marks. I've been usually right there by her side. But we were shopping in the store and I was looking for a camera lens, and as I was talking to the salesperson, Kara was standing beside me looking at an array of cameras that were on this counter. Each one of them was attached to a tether. And
much like
once the salesperson had pulled out a particular lens that I had wanted to examine more closely, my attention started to focus on the lens and not on my daughter, who had in the meantime taken this camera off the ledge and was looking through it, I suppose, and playing with it. I'm not sure how long a period of time it was before this particular woman made her comments. But it was enough time so that I had this kind of gut-level sense that I'd maybe not been paying attention to Kara for a little while. A woman, I wrote this down, I did sort of verbatim, a woman came up to me and in what felt like quite an angry tone asked me, "Do you see what your daughter is doing? Would you let your child, or let's see, how did she say that? Would you let her treat your camera that way?" She said, "I have 3 children at home and I don't let them play with my camera like that." And I think she even said something else, but by that time my eyes were down on my feet and I was feeling real awful. What I noticed was that my daughter had the camera on the floor, the lens barrel was pointed down towards the floor. I didn't really know what she was doing, but my instinctive reaction was to feel bad. Something bad was happening here. I had let my daughter abuse this camera, obviously. It felt like I was a bad parent. There was no way to respond. There wasn't any invitation that made it seem as if I could get out of that gracefully. I'm not sure what you hear in all of that, but for me it was mostly just this instantaneous reaction where I just shut down. I looked at my feet. I couldn't look at the woman in the eye. And fortunately, I had enough presence to not take out my shame on my daughter. I didn't grab Kara and say, "You awful little child, how could you be doing something like that?" But I felt a great need to appease this woman. And so I knelt down and looked at my daughter, Kara, and said, "Kara, it's I know that you're being careful playing with this camera lens, but it's I think this woman is right. It's probably not appropriate to play with these. I should be watching you when you're playing with it," and went on and on and on, less for Kara's sake than for this woman's sake, who I thought might overhear this, and I was maybe in the process going to raise my level of respectability. I still couldn't look at her in the eye. After I straightened up, and I think I may have even picked Kara up at that point, the salesperson kind of laughed it off and said, "Hey, you know, this is just kind of a torture test for these cameras. We're just, you know, we'll just consider it this is a test to see how well built they are," or something. He wasn't very concerned. And it was only after he said that it even dawned on me that this lady wasn't a salesperson. I was quite convinced that this was a salesperson bawling me out. Well, at that point, I started to feel angry because I had then the nerve to look up and look at this lady, who indeed was just a shopper in the store. And then I felt very angry at her. But the experience was that it just shut me down instantly when she came on like that, with her questions. "Do you see what your daughter is doing?" Which I interpreted immediately as, "No, I don't. I haven't been watching. Would you let her treat your camera that way?" There was a big hook in that one. Because for me, I'm pretty persnickety about my camera. And if I'm watching her, I'll let her play with it. But I'm very careful about the way she treats it. And I had this feeling that she was probably doing something to that camera that I wouldn't have let her do to my own. So what is shame? Well, I use that experience to just move into some kind of definition. There isn't really a descriptive statement that says this is what shame is. In general, one of the things you could say about shame is that it's simply feeling bad about who we are. So that for me in that instance, what I was feeling was, I'm a bad parent. Not that I've made a mistake, not that I've let Kara get out of my sight. Okay, parents do that every once in a while. But my feeling was, I'm a bad parent. Somehow, a good parent wouldn't do that. One of the problems with shame is that usually the way it's named or the way it's experienced is that the blame gets fixed, so that there's no possibility of taking responsibility for the action. There's really no possibility of redemption. You're simply accused and charged or sentenced, and unless you're willing to just deny the charge, you're stuck with the blame, and it has a way, if it's shame, of making us feel bad about who we are, not what we've done, but about who we are. And that's the difference, at least as I understand it, between shame and guilt. When one feels, I don't know that they, it seems like at one point they might have been used synonymously, those terms. Now, at least in family systems language, people are saying guilt is when you feel bad about what you've done. Shame is when you feel bad about who you are. Something is wrong with you and you can't fix it. So you're stuck there, and it's not a very comfortable feeling to be stuck with. A few more things about shame. Where does it come from, or why would someone feel that way? And I'm going to start with probably the riskiest one, but it's simply a pet peeve of mine. I step on some toes with this, but it's one that I think is so prevalent. I grew up with it, and for me, it's a way in which we very unconsciously set people up to feel ashamed. And it's what I call the good girl or good boy, bad girl, bad boy kind of language. it feels, or it's been my experience, and it feels as if it's pretty widespread, that parents and other individuals will often say to a child when they do something well, rather than saying, good job, they'll say, what a good girl you are, what a good boy you are for picking up your toys, for brushing your teeth, for finishing all your vegetables. Or you'll say, now be a good little boy, or be a good little girl, and wash your hands before supper time, and share your toys with your sister. But the language is such that what we say is, what we associate with or connect is that this particular action will make you a good little girl or a good little boy. So that one becomes good by performing. We might also say, good girls or good boys do this, or bad girls or bad boys do that. So that a child begins to learn at a very young age that when they do what their parents or other individuals expect of them, they're good. And when they don't share their toys, and when they hit their sister or brother, when they fuss or whine or throw tantrums, then they are bad. So that for the child, they're associating their performance with being good or being bad. So it's not that they've done something wrong, but that they are bad or they are good by their performance. For me, that's one place that shame has a very powerful beginning. I think our culture or society does a good job of reinforcing or contributing to our understanding ourselves in that same way. And I'll suggest two different ways that we do that. One is by suggesting that that there is a kind of fixed external standard of performance that people are expected to conform to. For example, and not all of these might make a lot of sense to you, but for example, we might say, or society might say, good people aren't selfish, or smart people get good grades, or normal people, I don't know what normal is, don't offend others, or Christian people don't harbor resentment, or people who are really together aren't needy. We hear a lot of those kind of statements, I think, I have in my lifetime. What one can come to believe when you hear those kind of statements, for example, take the one about Christians. Christians don't harbor resentment. If you hear statements like that, you might begin to think, if you harbor resentment, that you aren't Christian. Something is wrong with you. Okay? Good people who are loved, aren't selfish, and you're selfish, or you feel that you're selfish, what's wrong with you that you feel that way? If really together people aren't needy and you feel needy, then what's wrong with you? Another way that you can come by that, which I think is a little more subtle but possibly is even more powerful, is, I haven't found a good way to name it, but it would be something like this, that good people or attractive people or normal people are loved, so that if we find ourselves unloved, we could start to believe that there's something wrong with us. If our experience in a family is that people don't pay attention to us, or if it's at school or in a work setting, that people don't seem to be paying attention to us or don't seem to be loving us, a person can feel that something's wrong with them that others don't love them. So that, for me, one of the big things that happens then from society is that there is created a belief that there is this kind of external standard of performance, that people who are together or Christian or whatever behave in a particular way. And when we don't behave in that particular way, especially when we're striving to behave in that way, a person can begin to think that something is wrong with them. Another way that that can happen is that in society or other settings, there can be enough pressure to conform that one can begin to believe that differences are bad. It's not okay to be different, and that if you are different, something is wrong with you. Now, these don't always immediately convert into shame, but they can. And I'm going to try to talk a little bit about what happens if we buy into that kind of general belief system that there is this external standard that defines who we are as people. One of the things that is interesting about shame is that it doesn't take another person to make us feel ashamed. In fact, it's often the case that after you've heard enough messages that are shaming, we internalize that, so we learn to shame ourselves. For example, a person might learn that it's not okay to be overweight, that emotionally healthy or together people aren't overweight. And a person could come to believe then that they aren't emotionally healthy, they aren't together, something's wrong with them, that they can't keep their weight in check. A person might also believe that, well, if you're overweight, you should lose weight. They might hear that. Okay, so I'm overweight, well, that has happened, but now if I'm really together, I'll lose weight. However, if they're not able to lose weight, they can think that then something's even more wrong with them. Now then the problem is not just that they're overweight, but they're not able to lose weight. And again, they start telling themselves, what's wrong with me that I can't keep this weight off? What's wrong with me that I can't lose? I see other people losing weight. You start making comparisons. And we can begin to feel that something inside, something isn't quite right with us, that we are like this. And we do quite a good job often in those settings of telling ourselves that we're bad. You don't have to have anyone else tell us that we're overweight. Usually that message gets so internalized that we continue to shame ourselves every time we put on clothes and notice that they're big or tight, or that we look funky or sloppy or whatever one would feel, or every time you eat a little more than your neighbor sitting next to you or whatever. There can be a myriad of experiences that can reinforce that. So that for a lot of people, they're their own best shamers. It shouldn't surprise anyone that it's an instinctive reaction to defend against shame. I'm not sure exactly how it works for everybody, but it seems for me that something kicks in pretty quickly in defense. When I'm feeling ashamed, something kicks in. And there's a number of different ways that one can defend against it. To use the example of being overweight, one of the things a person could do is what we could call denial. Could simply say, I'm not overweight. I'm 10 pounds heavier than normal, but you know, that person's overweight, but not me. We could find a way to say, I'm not overweight. Or we could rationalize our weight condition. We could say, well, I'm a little heavy now, but my life has been really stressful lately. And I've been eating because I've been sad, or I've been depressed, or I've been too harried. And when those factors change, then I won't be overweight. So we rationalize away. Or, and this for me has been one of the most persistent ways of defending against shame, we can try to outperform it so that I might say people won't notice my weight problem if I become the best student in school, become the best athlete, become the best musician, make the best meals, become the best public speaker. We become seekers after perfection. People won't notice our imperfections if we're perfect in every other way. And so perfectionism oftentimes is a sign of one defending against shame. I want to move pretty quickly to some question and answer dialogue, but at this point I want to make a claim that, so we lay out this picture of shame, why would we be talking about, why spend the time talking about it? We've all had that experience, we all defend against it. Why is it important to talk about? There are a lot of different reasons for me to talk about it. In particular, for me, what has happened in my own life and what I've observed happening in other people's lives is that what shame has the power to do, if widespread enough, is to cause us to be very reactive with our lives. Instead of feeling free to act out along the lines of our own agenda and to feel comfortable about who we are, we become very reactive, we become people-pleasing, performance-oriented, defensive, anxious, tired, depressed. There can be a whole list of ways in which shame can cause our lives to become, to a greater or lesser extent, unmanageable. What has been important for me, and as I observe family systems, what I think is important in dealing with shame is to recognize where it comes from for you, to recognize how you respond, and not so much to eliminate it. I don't think that I will ever get to a point where I won't feel ashamed, but to find a way to respond to that shame in a healthy way, and to be freed from feeling the need to outperform it or to deny it or to rationalize it or otherwise to take on that feeling in such a way as to short-circuit our own agenda and self-esteem. I think at this point what I'd like to do is to try to guide the discussion a little bit unless people have specific questions they want to raise right now. Maybe I'll ask that first. Do you have specific questions now? Otherwise, I have kind of a sequence that I thought I'd pursue. Sure, we can. I don't mind which order we take. Oh, for example, well, that's all right. I'll respond to this one now. And I wouldn't mind. What I'd like to do is to have people in the class respond as well. In other words, I think your experience is as valid as mine, so that we all. We all come with some understanding of how it works in our own life and how we have found ourselves both maybe responding in unhealthy ways and responding in healthy ways to shame. But, for example, to use the story of the camera episode, camera shopping episode, in that particular instance, what I felt immediately was ashamed. What I can see in that is not that I'm a bad parent. What I can learn is, what one way to learn it, I think the way it was named for me kind of hooked me into feeling bad. But one of the things that I can do, maybe walking away from that situation, is to say, I made a mistake. Mistakes are okay. It's probably true that I should have been watching my daughter when she was playing with something expensive like cameras. I have been able to say in that particular instance, that wasn't a real good thing to do. I should or could have thought through a way to try to watch Kara Ann do the lens. But so I didn't, all right? So I forgot about it. I was excited about looking at a lens. I didn't pay attention. There she was. She had the camera on the floor doing whatever that this lady was very worried about. Well, I made a mistake. One of the things that isn't necessarily built into the shame-based system, but that's a part of a healthy understanding, is that people make mistakes. That's all right.
My thing, who had the problem? To me, the lady had more problem mm-hmm. than the salesperson or you.
Right.
She actually had the problem.
Mm-hmm.
She took the problem and dumped it on somebody. And had
mm-hmm. That's right. And there's a lot of people, I think, that are willing to do that. Yeah. Yes?
Well, on the other hand, neither you nor the lady nor the salesperson knew whether or not your daughter was doing anything to harm that camera.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the way you dealt with it not only was healthy in dealing with what you labeled as shame, but was healthy in dealing with what you described as being anger, which unfortunately is too appropriate a response of people when somebody else says something to them critically. They react angrily because somebody had the affront, had whatever it was that motivated them to criticize us. We react angrily because of the tone of voice.
Mm-hmm.
We react angrily because we're in a public place and somebody has something critical.
Yes. Yeah, a lot more power in a public place.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
The lady maybe didn't say it in most polite terms, but maybe anger wasn't a healthy way to react to it either.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you first started talking, you mentioned the 12-step groups, and somehow there must be a tie into the shame-based. Could you talk a little more on that?
Can you be a little more specific? Just
you said that you were involved in two.
Yeah.
12-step groups.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I missed part of the conversation or what, but it had something to do with shame. But is that part of a positive?
Yeah, for me, one of the groups I'm in is called Adult Children of Alcoholics, and for the people in my particular group, it seems as if one very common denominator is shame. All of us have learned to feel quite ashamed under certain circumstances. It varies what triggers it for us, but something triggers it, and there are some real common characteristics. One of the very common characteristics is that we look to others to define who we are. And so when they tell us we're falling short, we feel like we're falling short. And we aren't able to recover as quickly from that because of all the years of training that has reinforced the belief that they're the ones who are the appropriate judge of our behavior. So we've really given away that power to other people.
Couldn't you also yourself be critical too? Because someone's criticizing you, you could turn around and criticize your daughter, saying, hey, basically you're passing the buck. You know, someone has shamed you and you're going to shame somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe you feel a little better because you've taken it away from yourself. But you didn't, which was I think, the proper way to handle it.
Well, I was glad I didn't dump on my daughter. There was a day when I probably would have been much more inclined to do that, but transferring the blame is one workable strategy, not a very satisfactory one.
That's often a form of child abuse, is to verbal child abuse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree.
You know, I have had experiences where, especially in parenting sorts of things, if somebody else attacks what I've done or haven't done or whatever and says, you know, do something different or how come this or so-and-so doing something such that, you know, you spoke. One of the things my mind goes through, are they right? Am I right? What should I have, you know, and so I end up getting real confused, which then makes it hard to respond if indeed a response necessary to that person or to a child or whatever, because then I'm no longer feeling like, it takes me longer than a few seconds
mm-hmm.
for them to refigure that
mm-hmm.
out as to what's the right thing to be doing. And, you know, then I feel really bad because I'm confused, then I'm not going to get angry or respond in a way that I wouldn't otherwise, just because I'm getting confused. And And I, sometimes that's happened with my children, but I could later say, you know, say, I'm sorry I responded that way. I was feeling very confused. But it still happened at that moment in the class, and I still, I would like to be able to clear it out of myself, you know. How can you not get feeling that way, you know, if it's possible? I don't know. You know, how do you...
Does someone want to respond to that? It's a good question. Yes.
I find in situations like that that I want to say I'm confused. Mm-hmm. Right off the bat, tell them.
Good.
I'm confused and I feel a little out of control right now. And that lets the child and everyone around me know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I've lost it and said something or transferred or done it, but then I apologize. But most of the time that just stops it, and then I'm able to just give myself permission to be there and feel whatever it is and
take the time out to figure it out.
Take the time right then to figure it out. You're the most important person, especially when you know you've got little toddlers hanging around and you want to pass this stuff on to them.
This is really shooting from the hip, but when for me, I'll say it this way. For me, what I can feel in that instance is that, you know, a normal person would be able to sort that all through right away.
You know? Right.
And I'm quite the opposite. I'm just a jumble of feelings in that situation, and they're so tangled up at the time that it takes a while for that to sort through. And I've learned by now that it. Or at least I've come to believe it's not going to go any quicker. I don't flash into thinking mode then. I'm just feeling.
But also think you may not be. Maybe that's a more normal response. I mean, if we do, we. I mean, I realize it to myself. If I were a good person, a normal person, a together person, you know, whatever, I would do this, or I would do that, or my house would be this way, or you know, or something else. But maybe. Those things we set up for ourselves really are not what most people experience, what the norm really is. Or we set ourselves up with a sort of perfection ideal. Mm-hmm. Somehow we've done that. And whereas if we talk to people who maybe we thought showed that perfect thing that we think we're supposed to be able to do, they don't really feel that. And they've got their thing inside themselves too, and that we really are all coming out of a...
One of the most life-changing things I ever read or experienced was in some adult children of alcoholics literature, which said, it's talking about the myths that adult children grow up with, and it said adult children believe that there's such a thing as normal. My eyes just bugged out. I thought, you mean there isn't? I was firm. That was one thing I had never challenged, ever. I was convinced that there was a normal.
Well, you're taught it.
Mm-hmm.
In psychology,
there's
a normal, you know, there's
these
years and normal.
Sure, I don't know if they call it normal psychology, but you certainly have abnormal psychology.
and whether you have any dependency in your family or not. I grew up thinking that, well, sometimes I want to be normal. That's exactly what I want to be. Other times, normal's not good enough. I want to be better than that, above average. So I too thought that, and sometimes still think that there is such a thing.
Now, where are we getting all this from? Is it being because we're ashamed of other people and trying to please what they think we should do?
Well, that was one of the questions I'd like to pose. The first two that I had wanted to raise in this context was one just. For us to, if we could just kind of brainstorm, what for you causes you to feel shame? And the other is, have you been able to identify where that comes from? I suggest that there's maybe a few different places where that comes from.
I think a lot comes from your parents' expectations of you.
And I think there is a general acceptable norm that we live with. We hear it and we expect that our children will live up to that level, that we will perform up to a certain level. It's just kind of a generally accepted image. We don't know that.
And but it's so vague that we can't state what it is.
Yeah. That peer acceptance is one thing that feels pressure and you feel shame if you don't receive the if you're not like the others of your peers.
I'm being a little flip here. The nice thing about shame, of course, is that it spans the generations. Yeah, I think of my grandfather when he was 82 or 3. It had been 7-8 years after his wife had died. He started dating, and of course, 82-year-old men don't start dating. Lots of folks are really concerned about that. Now, I don't know, that caused him a lot of shame, but that could have. He lived till 95 and didn't seem to bother him too much. Yes?
As an adult child of an alcoholic, I think that there's an overdeveloped sense of responsibility that plays into this. And you grow up feeling no control, so you feel overly responsible many times for too much. And then if something comes along that is a situation that maybe doesn't have any bearing on you personally, or in a situation, a group dynamic, and something goes wrong, that over sense of responsibility kicks in, and then you feel ashamed of yourself for not being able to handle it, when neither one of those were ever, you're not responsible for it. Mm-hmm. It's learning boundaries, personal boundaries, like in your instance, that woman would have come up to me, and my personal boundaries as a mother are so clearly defined, I would have said, you are out of line, lady. I mean, you're way out of line. And I probably would have said, I'm sorry, I hate to be your kids. You're talking to me like this. I hate to see how you're making those kids care for that camera. Mm-hmm. So I would have not... Mm-hmm. I would have been real clear on that issue.
Yep.
Not to say I have my own.
Sure.
There are certain I have my own. But I think it has something to do with that personal line of responsibility that we don't grow up with from this point.
Basically, what she's saying, she's reversing the shame. She's saying, lady, you've got a problem. You're not normal.
It could be heard that way. There's... Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I don't think that. I mean, I will tell you, I would feel a little embarrassment if a woman would do that. But I wouldn't, have to. It wouldn't take me a long time to recover from it. But maybe if my husband had happened to, like you, who's now the primary parent that knows that kids are kids and that you're not a perfect parent all the time, that. Because he's not with him all the time. He hasn't worked through it in these situations that something would happen. But I would have felt like a little embarrassed, but I wouldn't have personally. I think I would have been real quick to catch on that it's really her problem. That she didn't have her boundaries. It wasn't her camera. And it wasn't...
Can I pick up... This is just something that might be helpful for the group. Maybe not. Might be helpful for me. Just to talk about how subtle shame is, one of the things that's true about me and my wife is that I take quite an equal responsibility for raising our children. We're each half-time pastors and probably have spent for the last 2 years much more time with my 3.5-year-old, given the pregnancy and now early infancy with our new daughter, Abby. So that as I hear it, and I know you didn't mean it this way, but when you're saying, if my husband who had spent more time with the children, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I can start thinking, well, I do spend more time with the children, and I still did that. You see how it...
Yeah.
And so,
I'm
glad you said it.
My husband didn't spend as much time with the children, and he's not as adept at handling those interpersonal things. And I don't mean that in any way to put down on him or you.
But I'm delighted that you said that, yeah. because even something like that can reinforce for me this stuff that goes on inside, because what I can hear, and shame is a way of hearing.
Yeah.
You can say, I mean, almost anything can be shaming, mm-hmm. all right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, almost anything can be shaming, and what I can hear in that is, oh, well, now I am spending all this time with my children, I still did that, what's wrong with me? Okay? That's I'm not feeling ashamed right now.
No.
But what you said helps me to be able to lift up another way in which that works.
Why are we always so willing though to assume shame?
Hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
why do we lack a feeling of self-worth? Why do we lack self-confidence in ourselves?
Shame. Great question.
Shame seems to come first of all
mm-hmm.
to us. Whereas I would almost, I mean, the ideal thing I think would be to say, I am okay.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful question.
As our son is yes. who helped or hurt, about the first lesson we teach kids is, God say to Adam and Eve, shame, shame,
mm-hmm.
you broke my rules, out of the garden.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do kids handle that?
When I grew up, it was quite common for parents or anyone else to say, well, shame on you.
Yes, oh yeah.
I did that.
Well, in the language, look at some of the hymns, especially the Lenten hymns. They're wonderfully shaming, talking about how worthless we are. And look at some of those. They'll use shame in there more than a few times. You know? Yes.
Did it do me any harm? That's what I mean.
What's that?
Did it do me any harm if they said shame?
Oh, did it? Okay. I mean, we can recover from it, sure.
That's what I was... I mean, it seems like shame is... I mean, we all have it.
Okay.
So it all exists in us. Is it something we try to get rid of entirely? Or is there some value or some worth to shame? We're just not using it properly.
Okay. Did everyone hear the question? Is there some value or use to shame? Okay. I'm only hearing a couple of people say that, but I'm enough of in accord to summarize that. For me, what shame does is to make us feel bad about who we are, not about what we've done. And there's no way to take responsibility if we simply feel that we're wrong. Something about us is wrong, isn't right. So that for the one who is shamed, you simply feel bad and probably find a way to beat yourself or someone else up about it. Whereas I think if one can convert that, say, into guilt, where one instead reacts to a situation or understands in a situation that they have simply done something wrong or inappropriate or does insensitive, whatever it was, but sees it as a mistake, works to make amends, and claims the gift of grace and acceptance and reconciliation, we move beyond that without getting stuck. Mm-hmm. I'm not...
I think a lot of people who were shamed identified it as guilt, and that's why perhaps it didn't do the damage that it could have done. Rather than not thinking, at least as I think back, I never thought of myself as not measuring up or not being what
mm-hmm.
I should be.
Mm-hmm.
But that I had done something wrong.
That's good.
Well, another way of the difference is instead of I made a mistake, I am a mistake.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And all of me is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
About 10 or 12 years ago, I heard a lecture. A scholar from the University of North Dakota was speaking at Davis, California. I think it was in the philosophy department, and I think his field was philosophy and linguistics. And he was talking about the Northern European concept of quen, which is shame,
mm-hmm.
and was suggesting, among other things, and I don't remember the lecture much, except that I remember that it was sort of the glue that kept the society together for a whole major part of what is now the English-speaking part of the world and the German-speaking part of the world and the Scandinavian language-speaking part of the world. And it's very different from anything that you don't find it, for example, in Latin countries. And so family systems operate differently in France and Italy and other places from the way that family systems operate in Northern Europe. And he was pinning it to the concept of quem.
It's
concept of what?
Quem. It's S-K-A-umlaut-M. Quem. Shame.
It's a bit unfortunate in some ways that we don't try to connect shame with some of the other influences, especially family systems influences, like family systems that are heavily codependent or addictive in some way. But I think that all contributes, and we just simply can't discuss all that today. I think that's also part of the issue.
It's interesting when you brought up this family systems. I was in Georgia, and a man who happened to be Iranian, as I talked to him later, was telling his little boy had run his little Debbie's little carts in the stores, the grocery stores, and he'd run Kelly into Kelly's, my daughter's, cart, and she'd fallen over. It was a total accident. And he just started berating his child, and the little boy automatically stood like this and started hitting himself. And I thought, oh, my heart ached for the amount of infliction and I said, oh, it was not his fault. It was no problem. And I stood our focus to him who he was and what he, to talk to him more. And when he said he was Iranian, I saw the pictures of when they did this with the chains, and the egg, and I thought,
gosh, there's a whole system of that. Mm-hmm. It's very insightful. I've read a book called The 1 Minute Scolding that deals with how parents can tell a child in no uncertain terms what they did that wasn't appropriate and how it made the parent angry and whatever. And then after you've told the child what was wrong, then you end the minute with hugging and reassurance that you still love the child, and that's an oversimplification. But anyway, since I read the book, I've been doing two things. One, I've been trying to implement with my kids. Easier said than done, but it helps a little bit. And I've been trying to implement it with myself.
Uh-huh.
That after I do something, instead of going over and over and over it in my mind, instead of replaying it, and instead of justifying it or denying it or rationalizing it or blaming somebody else for it, I try to just say, okay, I blew it, but I'm still lovable, I'm still capable, so what, let's go on. And I think it's more valuable for a 1 minute scolding to myself. Mm-hmm.
That's great.
You made a comment, this is off sudden, just a little bit, about the idea of after scolding a child and hugging them. One thing my wife and I have always tried to do, when one is scolding the child, the other one is basically off in the distance. They are one-on-one, they take care of the situation, and the hug is over, the situation, the problem is over. And I've seen so many times when one parent will scold the child and they run to the other parent. And the parent who's scolding never has a chance to explain what's going on, to show the hugging, that they love him, and they run to the other parent and say, well, the other parent doesn't love me. And this creates a battle back and forth, too, between parents.
Or the other parent will pick up on the same thing and they'll get it twice.
Yes.
The double whammy.
You talk about feeling pounced upon, I mean, I think that's a good point. It's a standpoint, too, that once one parent has dealt with it, it's over and it's done and it should be,
right.
And
the hug just says, hey, you're worth something. I think it kind of takes the shame away to a certain extent, too. They are in trouble for what they did, but they're not shamed for being a bad person. That's taking the shame away from the child, mm-hmm. which I think sometimes parents have a tendency to keep putting shame on the kid, and that's kind of... Yeah.
The thing is, recently I sort of had this sort of awareness of somehow the neatness of kids, But how much we grow and learn by positive affirmation, by supporting the things that we do right, by being shown love and acceptance, you know, those are easy terms to say, but, and as I've been here, as I've gotten another sense of this, and of course a sense of the ideal, the perfect, which makes it hard to be that way, so it's easy to, you know, get mad every time you fall down when you're with your kids, but it's been harder and harder for me to feel good about having my kids in school. Because I haven't yet found, I shouldn't say yet, I mean there are places, but that is one a place at this point that feels like, in so many situations, a bestallion, whatever the word is, where people are still treated that way.
Mm-hmm.
As I get more awareness of some new way of treating human beings, which has outstripped the time it takes to learn to do a new thing, I mean, it won't be my generation that stops doing this. Maybe we'll get a little bit better. Maybe the next generation will be a little bit better, you know. To watch my kids have teachers who are doing this shame kind of thing, in some ways often, or having setups of kinds of competitions or other things that make kids feel this way. I feel like I'm just putting them in that situation of something I don't believe is a way of responding. And helping kids grow into happy kids with good feelings of self-worth. I don't know if I can do any better in those situations. You know, I mean, I don't know what to do about that, but it just makes it another struggle as a parent mm-hmm. when you see something as an ideal, anyway.
Any responses to that?
Again, as a function of shame, I mean, the real function of it, is it to maintain order? I don't understand where it came from.
Why would people shame others?
Yeah, what's the purpose behind it? Because, I mean, it's so pervasive. All of us have certainly many experiences with it. And why do we continue to use it?
It's called control.
It is control.
That was the first word that popped into my mind.
Right.
It's very controlling. Yeah. Very effective. I mean, I think it works.
I would like to add that my mother was into shame continually. Until about a year ago that I received some counseling and learned how to respond to her. She has now discovered that it doesn't work with me anymore. So she has turned it on my son, who's in his early 20s and has a couple of small children. And now I'm trying to decide how I'm going to handle that. I thought I had cured the problem with her not shaming me anymore, but now it's happening to my kids.
Let me say a couple things real quick because our time is slipping away. A lot of people, I think, find their own lives to be of such a state that it seems like they abandon, they kind of give up on their own and they start deciding that they'll take care of someone else's life because it's easier than mm-hmm. taking care of their own problems. So that I think there's a host of folks in our society that are quite willing to tell you what to do because they'd rather not work on themselves. For me, what I'd like to spend this last time with is who tells us who we are or who decides who we are? As people.
It should be God, I think. No, a spiritual, who we are as spiritual people.
Do we really believe we're loved?
Mm-hmm. It's a biggie. That's surely at the heart of our faith.
Whoever we feel most dependent upon is the one or those ones who define who we are, I think. And so it may change through life.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
I am the only one who can know who I am. Mm-hmm. From the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know ourselves. Really. It's only the Lord really knows us.
And what does the Lord really know about us? The Lord really knows that we're wonderful. Mm-hmm. God created us and
mean, right there in Genesis, it says we are very good. You know, everything else is just good. Mm-hmm. But, you know, God looks at us and says we're very good.
Mm-hmm. He also knows human beings.
It's a little self-serving to throw this in, but to pick up on a comment that was made earlier about the influence of Sunday school, it feels like there's a lot of people in the helping professions, in particular now in the church, who have a stake in how Christian children, for example, turn out, maybe Christian adults as well. And it can easily happen that we hold up stories not just as a way of suggesting how God's people interact with each other or interact with God or examples of how this particular individual lived out their life of faith. But we can easily hold up these stories as standards for how God's people behave, so that what we hear in that is that as a Christian, this is what I do. And it's not quite as easy as to say there's none of that involved in that there is no way of saying that Christians love or that Christians forgive. But when that becomes a rigid standard which we measure ourselves against, we can suggest to people that even with God we're falling short, and their relationship with God can be one of feeling ashamed and anything but feeling accepted. We talk about unconditional love and acceptance. People can feel anything but that before God and end up doing the same thing with God that they do with other people, trying to outperform their shame. And so we've called it works righteousness or any number of other things in the church. But that...
Okay, I wondered about, and you teach some of those stories, and you're, and so often I use examples of how you misbehave, and so on. I wondered about that. On the one hand, we do need to learn. I teach our kids, you know, things that we should be aiming for. How do you make that balance of helping them see this, of hearing the stories and whatever, without having it turned into something, well, if I don't measure up to this, I'm bad, you know. What words do we use, you know? Examples.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's a real tricky thing.
Mm-hmm.
Real. Then I'm trying to help with that.
I struggled with that last week. I was working with a 9 and 12 year old, and it was community day or living together or something like that. So we went down to the, you know, garbology doc and talked to the folks who were doing garbology and kind of asked them some questions and stuff. And I'm sure what they heard was, "Be sure to sort your garbage." And we never said that. We were talking about how we're all working together to keep, you know, holding, you know, clean as possible. And as I walked away, you know, after 20 minutes of talking about it or whatever, I thought, you know, they heard sort your garbage. You know, that was not what I was saying. I think some stages of development, kids just internalize everything as that's what I'm supposed to do. You know, because I know that I never said sort your garbage. That wasn't the point, but that's what they heard. And so it is hard to, how do you get a different message across?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, for us who feel shame and who've lived a life, and we don't have families that have given us the love and acceptance that enabled us to feel shame and feel it appropriately, there's a great book right now that talks about healing the child within.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in one chapter, it talks about you begin to share a feeling, and some people will just. They'll just not respond because they've never dealt with that issue before. And then the book talks about that's not a person that you want to be sharing that with. Then moving on to finding a small group of people who you can share these uncomfortable situations with and be affirmed and accepted and rejoiced in for who you are. And the beauty of that is that it gives you the place to identify where and who you are as a person, because when you feel who you are as a person, and you have a nurturing group around you, and it may not be your spouse at the present time, or it may not be a close love mother or father, but it can be a supportive family in that sense, then you're on the way.
Yep, that's a good point. We're about at the end of our time. I wanted to just say, make one more response, and I say this more out of a from the perspective of a pastor. than as sort of a participant in what? In the influence of shame. But in my particular congregation, which I doubt is very dissimilar from yours, we delight in stories that make us look good. We have a harder time in stories that make us look bad. We're learning something from Garrison Keillor, if that's a person that you're familiar with, about laughing at ourselves. But that we come by that very slowly, and it's amazing when I read the Old Testament to look at all of the stories that were included, not just good but bad. I wonder if our church had been the community of faith of that time, if we would have included half those things. We wouldn't have even whispered at some of them. I mean, the worst things, the adultery and murder and all that sort of stuff. I think the Old Testament and New Testament are ripe with stories that we could recover to hold up our humanness. I mean, these are what the people of God are about. They're real people. They sometimes they're very, very good, and sometimes they're horrible. But they're still God's people. God still loves them. God still makes covenant with them. God chews them out sometimes, motivates them, strengthens them, empowers them, feeds them. And we as a congregation are working pretty hard at trying to recover that sense of gracefulness about our humanness. It's okay to be who we are. And the ability to laugh or to forgive ourselves when we fall down. I blew it. And then we pick ourselves up and thank God that there's forgiveness, and we work the process of reconciliation, which isn't always easy, but we work for that healing and move on. So, thank you for the discussion today. It was wonderful to have you here.